Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Naomi Oreskes, who is a history professor at the University of California, San Diego, where she focuses on the history of science. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the U.S. Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. Her books include Plate Tectonics, An Insider's History of the Modern Theory of the Earth, and The Rejection of Continental Drift, Theory and Method in American Earth Science. Her latest book, co-written with Eric Conway, is Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. Welcome to Background Briefing, Naomi Oreskes.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
And the president outlined a number of initiatives to address global warming in his State of the Union address. And in the response from the – actually, there are two responses from the Republicans, both from Tea Party Senators Rand Paul and Marco Rubio. But in the official, Republican response from Senator Marco Rubio, in his rebuttal, he derisively dismissed climate change, saying our government can't control the weather. So what does the president do in the face of this kind of Republican obstruction and denial?
Well, I think the first thing is the president has to confront these false claims and explain to the American people why they're false. The fact is, in a deep way, the government actually does control the weather. We've had government policies that for more than 100 years have fostered and subsidized the development and use of fossil fuels. And in doing that, we have consciously, not deliberately, but we have consciously increased our use of fossil fuels that produce the greenhouse gases that are driving climate change. And of course, climate is a word for all the different bits of weather put together. So through our government policies, we in fact have created a situation that has created climate change. So it's not true actually to say that the government doesn't control weather. In a very deep and fundamental way, actually we do.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know whether you know about this new study that's come out from the University of California, San Francisco, which is funded by the National Cancer Institute and the National Institute of Health, which traces the roots of the Tea Party's anti-tax movement back to the early 1980s with funding from tobacco companies. The study's called Tobacco Control, and the study is titled "The Quarterback Behind the Scenes: Third Party Efforts and the Tobacco Industry and the Tea Party with the Tobacco Industry and the Tea Party." I brought it up because of your book.
Yes, did
you recognize the kind of control, the connection there?
Absolutely. In a way, this could be another chapter in our book, Merchants of Doubt. So in Merchants of Doubt, one of the things that Eric Conway and I were trying to do was to track and explain and understand the history of climate change denial. Why were all these people challenging overwhelming scientific evidence? Why were they claiming that there was no scientific consensus when all of the available evidence showed that, in fact, there was? And what we were able to show is that there were very strong connections between the folks who challenged the scientific evidence of climate change today and people who had previously challenged scientific evidence on other issues that pointed to the need for government regulation, government intervention in the marketplace, and that included acid rain, the ozone hole, and tobacco. And it was that link back to tobacco that for us was, you know, this really sort of shocking discovery that the tobacco industry had actually funded climate change denial. And at first you think, well, how does that make sense? Why does the tobacco industry even care about climate? Well, the answer is the tobacco industry cares about regulation. The tobacco industry wants to weaken the federal government because it's the federal government that has the strongest potential hand in remedying the market failure that tobacco smoking is. Now, of course, states acted. States and local authorities were important, too, and the tobacco industry attacked those as well. But it's this attempt to undermine the credibility of regulation, to undermine the credibility of the role of the federal government that was the central reason why the tobacco industry did this. So it's very interesting to me that Rubio would say, well, the government can't fix this. That's consistent with this whole pattern of trying to undermine the federal government in order to weaken the resolve of people like us, the resolve of citizens. Because if you can convince people that the federal government is bad, the federal government is incompetent, the federal government can't fix things, it just makes a hash of things when it tries to do so, well, that becomes a very powerful cultural argument against government intervention, whether it's tobacco or climate change. And so this latest chapter, and you know, that's part of the work of my good friend and colleague Stan Glantz at UCSF and his terrific group there who has just done amazing work on this history. This is hard stuff to ferret out. The tobacco industry obviously tries to hide its role, but what we've been able to do through research is to show that the tobacco industry fingerprints are all over this stuff.
Well, it's not just the tobacco industry's fingerprints, but the front group that was created back in 1984 by, guess who, the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, which got funding from Philip Morris and other tobacco companies between 1991 and 2004, was called Citizens for a Sound Economy.
Yes.
And
that's typical of the patterns we see. So very often they have these very nice sounding names, Citizens for a Sound Economy, Americans for Prosperity, Citizens for a Better Environment, Informed Citizens for the Environment. That was one group that I did some research on. So they always have attractive names. And of course, something like Americans for Prosperity. Well, who wouldn't be for prosperity? But when you scratch the surface, what you find is that these are essentially front organizations, either for tobacco or the fossil fuel industry or other regulated or potentially regulated industries, again, that are trying to undermine the case for a government role.
Again, I'm speaking with Naomi Oreskes, who's a history professor at the University of California, San Diego, where she focuses on the history of science. She is the author, with Eric Conway, of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. So in terms of what the president put up there tonight, last night at the State of the Union in terms of addressing the threat of climate change, his rhetoric is always wonderful, and he's unquestionably doing the right thing. But the question I would have is, did he put forth these proposals with sufficient urgency? Because the task ahead requires a kind of a Manhattan Project type of response, or Jack Kennedy's pronouncement to put a man on the moon and bring them back. Those kind of initiatives. I mean, here he is somewhat spread thin, it would seem, having to respond to gun control, which the Democrats shied away from because of what happened in Connecticut, and the economy. The Republicans are about to tank the economy and bring us back into another recession if this sequester goes through. So he's got immigration. He's got a whole bunch of things on his plate. What was your sense of whether he rose to the occasion on climate change?
Yeah, it's a tough question because obviously, as you say, he has a lot of things on his plate. There are lots of people pressing on lots of issues that they consider important, and he's got to make political judgments about priorities. So obviously, people like myself who have been involved in this issue were happy that he spoke about it. That's an important step in the direction. Happy that he confronted that this is real, that we know it's real, that the evidence is overwhelming, and happy that he made some concrete suggestions about how to move forward. Did he convey a sense of urgency? You know, I don't know. I guess you'd have to look at the opinion polls to see what people took away from his speech. But certainly, I do agree with what you just said, and I wrote a piece in the Washington Post about this just a couple of weeks ago. I do think that we need something like a Manhattan Project to address this issue because it has so many dimensions. It's so complicated, and energy runs through everything that we do. It runs through the economy from top to bottom. But that could be viewed as a good thing because there's an opportunity to connect the climate issue with the energy issue, which is also linked to national security, terrorism, jobs. And, you know, one thing the president did say, but I think needs to be underscored, one of the really good things about green energy is that it's very hard to outsource. It's very difficult to outsource wind energy. I sat next to a gentleman a few months ago at a panel who worked for a company that produces the blades for wind turbines, and they had just opened a new plant here in the United States to do that. And he explained to me that even though labor is more expensive in the United States than China, it costs so much to ship the turbine blades because they're so big that it ends up being economical to do that here in the United States. And the same is true for a lot of aspects of solar and other green energy technologies. So, I mean, we have a lot of evidence that green energy can generate jobs that are hard to export. And I do think he could do a better job of making that connection between energy, climate, the environment, jobs, and also terrorism, because as we all know, I mean, there's a reason that we're in Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan and all those places. And, you know, it's not only about oil, but it certainly has a lot to do with oil.
Well, even President Bush, who got us into the Iraq War, which the Iranians won, of course, right. And we lost, and the Iraqis lost. He even said that we're addicted to oil. He didn't say, of course, we're fighting drug wars, but right. Perhaps should have. But right. Naomi Oreskes, my concern is that because of this convention in our press that everything has an equal and opposite point of view, this phony balance, this binary idea that in the universe of discourse there are two equal and opposite black and white positions. So that has allowed deniers to be equated with climate scientists. It's allowed creationism to be equated with evolution. I'm hoping that the press gets away from that, because people like Marco Rubio ought to be shamed for their ignorance, don't you think? I mean, we don't have time for this nonsense.
Well, I agree. I do think it's kind of a sad thing that a person can say things that are so ignorant, as some people in this country have said, people who should know better, and not be called to task for it. So I'm glad that you are. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think the press has made some progress on this issue, but I do think it's really important for people to understand that the people who are challenging the scientific evidence on climate change, with very, very few exceptions, are not scientists, and they're almost never actually climate scientists. And the fact that someone gets funding from a third party doesn't necessarily mean that what they're saying is wrong. But when you see the role of the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry and other regulated parties, anti-tax groups, anti-government groups funding this disinformation campaign, then you have to open your eyes and say, look, this is not a scientific debate. It's a political debate. There are some incredibly vested interests behind this, like the tobacco industry, the Koch brothers, the oil and gas industry, the coal industry. These people do not have the interests of the American people at stake. They have the interests of their own industries at stake. And the irony, of course, is that oil and gas historically, I mean, at present, don't actually generate that many jobs in the United States. The oil industry generates very few jobs in the United States right now. Gas is a little bit of different because of the shale gas or fracking boom, but that's, you know, a topic for a whole different conversation. But the bottom line is they don't generate a lot of domestic jobs. And the jobs that they do, if you look at the coal industry, they're pretty terrible jobs. Coal is a very 19th century industry, and I think the president could do more to really paint a vision of a future based on clean energy and not based on, you know, the sort of hideous health, safety, community problems associated with coal, and even to a lesser extent, but to some extent with oil and gas as well.
Well, also, I think, you know, as much as the president could do more, I think the press could do more in terms of really taking a stance between fact and fiction. In Rubio's case, he's on the cover of Time magazine, you know, as the kinder and gentler face of the Republican Party.
Right.
I mean, he's running as imbecile in chief. I mean,
But I think also people expect too much from the press. I remember Time magazine under, Henry Luce was the one who wouldn't print the dispatches that Ted Sorensen sent from China that were telling the truth about what was really going on in China and the corruption among the nationalists and the popular support that actually existed from Mao Zedong, because he thought it would undermine American support for the nationalists in China. So Time magazine has a long history of not telling the American people the truth about things that it was uncomfortable with, uncomfortable with politically. Now, I'm not saying that that's exactly what's going on today. It's obviously more complicated than that. But I think sometimes we're a little naive about what we expect the mainstream press to do. And so we've got to be alert to that and realize that, you know, the mainstream press have their interests as well. And, you know, Stan Glantz, who did, you know, worked in the report you just mentioned, said he thought we were too soft in our book, In Merchants of Doubt, on, you know, the mainstream press, because, you know, we talked about what you just talked about, that the idea of journalistic objectivity and balance, that these were, objectivity is a good goal, but that they were interpreting it wrongly. And Stan said, no, this was about advertising. This was about the huge amount of money that the tobacco industry poured into mainstream media in advertising. So I don't think it's either or, it's probably both, but I think it's important for us to realize that the mainstream media does get huge amounts of money in advertising from tobacco, from fossil fuels. And they're also worried about access. I think the mainstream media is very worried that if they say things that are excessively critical of particular political leaders, they'll lose access to those leaders, and therefore that they have to be cautious about what they say. And I think we saw that a lot you know, during the previous presidential administration, that mainstream press were afraid if they were too critical, you know, they wouldn't be invited to the White House. So, you know, these issues are very tricky and complicated. Sure. And, you know, I guess that's why people need to read our book and really be educated about these issues.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Naomi Oreskes.
Great. Thanks. It's great to be on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with Naomi Oreskes, who's a history professor at the University of California, San Diego, where she focuses on the history of science. She received the Young Investigators Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the U.S. Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. And she is the author, with Eric Conway, of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about that the Pope's greatest act may have been his resignation.